Welcome, everybody. And tonight, I invited a wonderful devotee to be with us, another second-generation devotee, and her name is Bhakti Lata. So, Bhakti Lata, can you just tell everyone out there? Okay, let's see who's out there first. Brenda Lee, Adi, Mitra, Kremlin, Bhakti and Carol, Bhakti and Patrick, Rasa Rasika, oh my God, we haven't seen you here in like 10,000 years. Bhakti Patrick, well, all the old lates and greats have returned, as well as the regulars. It's, okay, this is great. So Bhakti Lata, tell everyone about you, yourself.
Well, I was born in New Vrindavan, across the street from Radha Vrindavan Chandra Temple, and I was raised there until I was 13, and then I moved to Hawaii, where I lived for 5 years, and then as soon as I hit 18, I moved to Alachua to be with the devotees. So I've been here for around 4 years, and it's an incredible community. It's beautiful with the devotees, and also as well as going to school and working and teaching, and eventually I'll be a teacher.
Okay, so now we have to clear up one other thing. The people who are looking at you may be thinking your parents are Indian. So can you explain?
This is probably the hardest question for Gurukuli to answer. Where are you from? And it's extra confusing for me because people think, they say, are you Indian? And I'm like, no, I'm not Indian, but my culture, my faith and everything is from India. My father is from Spain, and my mother's from Guam, which is a Pacific island. So they met before, they became devotees together. So
before you were born?
Before I was born.
Oh.
And they were married, and then they became devotees together. So, but I'm not Indian. And no one else in my family looks Indian. So,
but you can get in the Jagannath temple. Yes?
Maybe.
You didn't try?
We'll see. That's the ultimate test.
Oh. Oh, I heard they're letting Westerners.
I don't think so.
Anyway, so now I'm going to tell you why I invited Bhakti, and she doesn't even know why. So this is a surprise to her. See, we don't rehearse this. We don't even know what we're going to talk about, but we just get inspired when we see the camera. So, and this relates to the topic tonight. First, I'll preface it by the topic. We were discussing, well, what should we talk about? And she said, well, I go on the youth tour every year that goes to all the Rathayatras. And so on the youth tour, sometimes it's difficult. We're all crammed together. You're with people you don't know. You're with people that maybe you wouldn't choose to be with. And why don't we talk about that? And I said, well, yeah, that's a good idea because, you know, like if you go to work, you're with people you haven't chosen. And even when you get married, sometimes you realize, whoa, this person is not exactly what I thought. So you always have to learn how to adapt, right? So
adapt, yes.
about 3 years ago.
And I must say, the magic is in the adaptation. Sometimes that's where our good sides even come out.
Oh, yeah.
Manu Prabhu, who does these bus tours, he once described it like we're all on the bus and it's like potatoes when you're put into those big potato peelers. Everyone's kind of rough around the edges, and then after a while towards the end of the bus tour you're all just kind of smooth and you just get along, and it bring you
oh,
learn
yeah.
to just
right.
appreciate everyone for their values.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah. So the moral of the story is go on the bus tour and it'll smooth out your rough edges. Okay. Jai Dwaita Swami goes on the bus tour, right? Yeah.
So, Bhakti Marg Swami.
Yeah, you, there's no age limit. So anyway, about 3 or 4 years ago, the bus tour came back, right? And so one day, I don't know, morning, evening, something, I can't remember, you were talking to someone who was on the bus tour, and I was eavesdropping and listening. And the gist of what I thought was going on was that there are rules that everyone has to follow. And this one young devotee man didn't follow all the rules and he got reprimanded in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking to him because he was making excuses, like he was blaming the rules or blaming the person who made the rules or blaming how the rules were enforced.
This is 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. Or maybe I think it was at least three. Okay. If I had to bet on it, I would say three. So I was just walking by, minding my own business, and I overheard you talking. So I was just sitting there. I guess you weren't aware that I was sitting there, and I was listening to you speak to this young devotee man who was making one excuse after another and not taking any responsibility. And you were trying to talk sense to him. And I was so impressed by what you were saying, because it wasn't like, how old are you now?
I'm 22.
Yeah, so you were 19. So she was 19 when she said that, and I'm listening to that, and I'm going, this is not what comes out of a 19-year-old. I was like so impressed. It was like so grounded and so sensible and so helpful. And he was rejecting it, and you just were patiently talking to him. So then a few weeks ago, because what we're doing now is, I usually do the show alone, we're bringing people in because I want everyone out there to get the chance to see all the jewels of Alachua. And then I thought, we're talking about relationships, so we should ask Bhakti to come, because just based on what you said, I was so impressed.
Uh-huh.
So are you embarrassed now?
My God, I don't even remember that conversation. Yeah. But
I don't even want to say who. If I told you who it was.
You can tell me after the show.
Yeah, then you remember. But he has black
then
hair.
Then hopefully I'll remember.
As far as I know, he has black hair, and he has a brother who's a dentist. At least he looks like.
Oh, okay, I know who this is.
Do you remember the conversation?
I
don't want to embarrass.
Who it is.
If you think back to, you'll probably remember that conversation.
Yes.
So now, you don't have to say what you told him, but, so we're going to go to the topic tonight, which is being a potato thrown in a barrel of potatoes. So
yes.
So we're talking about relationships, so how do we deal in a situation where we're kind of thrown in? For us who lived in temples, we didn't really choose a temple. It was just the temple, and we didn't choose the people in the temple, and so we lived there. So it's very similar for us. Or you get married, and then there's a mother-in-law, the father, so we're always being thrown in from one job to another. So what was your realization of adaptation? Or anything you want to say.
I found, especially on the bus tours, that people I never thought that I would connect with, or people I even had some resistance to wanting to connect with, especially on the winter bus tours where we go to a Central America country like Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and everybody. It's not America, so we're all kind of in a zone that's not our normal space. So when we're kind of in that environment, we're just kind of forced to look at each other. We're our only company, the people who speak English, and you end up doing a lot of service together. And that's what I find what maybe binded people in the past in the temples and with a lot of the service that they did together, because it was the service. And I think that that's what happens on the bus tour, and is when you serve each other, then you can become closer. But if...
Serving each other and serving together?
And both. Serving together. Actually, it starts with serving together, because you don't really want to serve each other. You actually want to serve... You end up serving together. You have to. You cook together, you have to clean together, all those things. And in a way, it's serving each other, though, by serving together. That means that if we're cooking...
Supporting one another.
We're supporting one another. So I think that that attachment and that growth of a relationship begins with that service. And I think also we end up in a relationship where we're kind of... We're like, why am I in this? Or it's difficult. I really feel that if you just start serving that person, or then you can begin to have the potato can be more smooth,
especially the people you think you're gonna have a difficult time with.
Yes,
go for them first.
Exactly. I don't remember. I think I was on the winter bus tour, and they did a Japa retreat one year in Guatemala, And I was just having such a hard time. And Jairade, who's one of the directors of the bus tour, she said, well, why don't you look at the people you don't like and all the offenses you might be making? And I was like, oh my God, I'm making so many. And I just thought of all the people who could have been offended by my attitude or presence or whatever. And I was thinking, you know, those are the people especially that I need to be aware of and to at least develop some respect in my heart. Not that I'm going to go out and be friends with them, but I think relationships begin with respect. So if I can just learn to kind of just respect where they're at and who they are, then a relationship can grow from there, if it can.
Right.
But, you know.
Well, I have another question. Because I think it was Abraham Lincoln. Someone said, if you don't like somebody, it's probably because you don't know them well enough, so you should get to know them. So did you have that experience?
Like, I did.
Like,
I really
once you got
did.
To know them?
Yes. Yes,
so
I did.
So in other words, what you were thinking they were, it wasn't actually the way they were.
It wasn't actually, and I'm finding it, it's almost 90% of the time.
So
what I think of somebody is a certain way.
So why do you think you think that way before you know them?
Like make assumptions about who somebody is?
Because we all,
it's almost like a survival mechanism, you know? You have to kind of like, you make your evaluations, but they're so off. You know? We're such bad, really bad survivalists.
We're like, okay, these are the people I want to be close with, and these are the ones I want to stay away from because...
Yeah, and you make kind of external...
They walk this
validation.
Way, they dress this way, they talk this way,
exactly.
They come from this state,
But I find... it can kind of work when you're, like, I think, especially with devotees, that a lot of these preconceptions just fall away. They really, because Krishna is the common denominator.
So you find, in other words, is what you're saying, like, you find with devotees, it's like the onion, and whatever it looks on the outside, you peel it and you go, there's the devotee.
Yes.
It's always
there, because Krishna's there.
Yeah.
So when
they wouldn't even be on the bus tour if
they,
it's not like they're forced.
Yeah. Well, sometimes.
Their parents go,
sometimes.
Get out of here.
I mean, I always paid my way through and everything. But, I mean, it's kind of, when Krishna's that common denominator, then I think there's always a beautiful relationship to discover.
So then.
It's not the same with just... You know, you can learn from everyone, and actually realizing that everyone can be my guru, no matter who they are, no matter what, even
right,
if they're...
Well, let's save that thought for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start with the devotee.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go back to what you said is, because they're devotees,
mm-hmm.
when you get to that point, here's a devotee special, devotee's rare, he's giving his life to Krishna. So at that level, then everything's okay, everything's positive.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yes.
And then going back to the other point of that assumption, judgment, critical part, so that we first enter, because that's our defense to the world, or sometimes it's said, I don't know if this comes from Shastra, but the mind's defending the false ego. So we may just be defending ourselves by being critical or we're judgmental, this is good, this is bad, and then we're analyzing people. And so we go through, that's natural. We go through that, we see people, and, you know, we have this whole inventory in our mind. Well, if you dress this way, if you talk this way, if you grew up here, if your parents are like this, then therefore, it's like an addition problem, therefore. You must be like this, because the other guy who dresses this way is like that. So we're dealing with that. And then we go to the next level and say, wait a minute, this person... He's on here because there's some sincerity, there's something good, and I'm trying to be a devotee, he's trying to be a devotee, so there's this... So then we start to see the common bond.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be something to bond with if there's nothing common. So in a sense, we could say, well, for devotees, it's actually easier because we already know
what?
There is a bond. Just I know a lot of devotees have told me that when... they're away from devotees for a period of time. Let's say they go off to school in the state where there's no devotees. You know, it's at that point they start to see how different devotees are from non-devotees. And And 2 weeks ago, was it last? The weekend before last, I did two seminars, one for devotees and one for non-devotees. And the devotees had such a much easier time just letting go, but the non-devotees had a much harder time. So I was looking at that, and I was appreciating the devotees, that their hearts are so open. It was a real... So sometimes we need that.
It takes being away from it to really appreciate it. And that's exactly what happened when my family, we moved to Hawaii from 13 to 18. I literally did not have any friends for that teenage period. I chose to not, because there wasn't I didn't have a common denominator with anyone. There were just no devotees around in anywhere in Hawaii, and the nearest devotee or the temple was a plane ride away. And actually, I didn't go to an ISKCON temple, like Prabhupada temple, for a year and a half. Like, wow. I didn't leave the island, so I wasn't around devotees for so long. It was very hard, and it was in that environment that I really learned how special devotees are, and that when I'm in devotee association again, I never ever want to take it for granted.
Okay, so what island were you on?
The Big Island. And that's...
So the conclusion of this class is, if you're having difficulty with devotees, fly to the Big Island for at least a year and a half, and you'll really see what you're missing.
Yes. Yeah. I think my spiritual master, he says that when I asked a question about if we ever stop appreciating devotees, like, or if what do we do when we're around devotees that we don't really want to be around, and he said, when we stop appreciating devotees, you can take that as a sign that Krishna has severely, or when he's withdrawn his grace. And also when they criticize, when say one would start criticizing other devotees, that Krishna has withdrawn his grace.
So then you could turn it around and say, we need Krishna's grace.
Yes.
To be able to appreciate. Because,
yes, exactly.
Because there's always two sides. Everyone has faults, and Prabhupada said, even if you want, you can criticize me, I have faults. So if you want to find faults, you can find them in anyone. People will find fault in Jesus Christ, in what he taught. And so Prabhupada's point was, well, you can find both, so why would you want to find the fault? So then based on what you just said, we can say, well, that means Krishna's mercy is being withheld, and therefore I can pray to Krishna to be merciful to me, to allow me to see,
yes,
to see the good and the bad. No, don't say that.
We see the bad all the time. We don't need
good,
help.
See the good instead of the bad. or you could... No, so then you...
But it's almost like if we wreck... At least we're conscious enough to realize, oh my God, I'm criticizing these devotees. Then we can just pray to Krishna, please help me to not. And then with his grace, we can somehow...
Okay, so when you say... When Bhakti is saying criticize, she doesn't mean she goes up to them and tells them, I don't like you, or whatever it means, right? We're looking in the mind. So we all know that. We all do that because there are many reasons we do that. And part of it is natural because we evaluate life, what is good and what is bad, so we can make our own decisions. So we tend to do that. You know, is this the right time to do this? Is this the best way to go here? Should I eat this? Is this healthy? And then, you know, you can get into it a whole level. These foods are good, these foods are bad. This is the best way, this is to drive to this place, this is the best car, you know. So we're always doing that. And so then we take that into people. So we start evaluating people.
Yeah.
So we develop certain standards. Where do those standards come from? Well, they can come anywhere along the line growing up. Those are our particular standards. Usually there are standards for ourselves. And so when we don't see the standards we have for ourselves, someone else, then we say, well, that's bad. I had a really interesting experience with this. I grew up in the movement for maybe the first, probably like first 12 years, primarily distributing books. And so one of the problems we ran into in distributing books is evaluating who would be a likely person to take a book by how they look. And so, you know, we'd see young person, they would look cool. Then we go up to them. We'd see a businessman in a suit, and we go, "Oh no, you know, he's too uptight," or whatever. We'd see a young military man and say, "Oh, they're a nice boy from Iowa. They'll they'll take a book. They'll give us a donation. They're sweetie pie, you know, like that. So then I moved out of America to South Africa. And so I had the same standard of judging. And it was totally different. Because there, the well-dressed person in the suit that you would never stop in America was completely opposite.
Mm.
Aware of Indian culture, because there are Indians there.
Mm.
It was just totally different. And it was funny to watch it. And it was a great realization of the whole world of judgment, of how much you can't judge based on your standard, because people are always going to trip you up. Yes. And you're just going to look at yourself and go, that was stupid. You know, that had nothing to do with that person. And the other thing I see is that when we do that, it's extremely difficult or impossible to appreciate whatever good that person has, because you've now put them in a box. This is how they are. And it's not just non-devotees, the devotees also. So, well, if somebody does this, then I don't appreciate that. I don't like them. And so now I can't see anything good, which is so important in associating with devotees, to have a positive attitude, which is a sign of Krishna's mercy.
Yes.
And not only a sign of Krishna's mercy, it is the way we get Krishna's mercy.
Yeah.
To be, because we want blessings of devotees.
I think that to even appreciate someone, like it's often said that somebody's spiritual life begins with just appreciating the devotees,
right,
appreciating
right.
Krishna. And I think it's almost something that I want to do after with this interview is I really feel, especially after taking this one college class, that whenever there's a weakness in my life, or wherever there's something, that whenever I can get into that where I have a weakness, if I judge someone by what they look like, if I exploit that weakness and try and make it stronger, there's a power that comes from that. And so almost from this interview, I feel like I want to speak with someone maybe that I have like a weakness, or I don't connect with them, because there's a power there that is just waiting to kind of be unleashed. Because if we can get over that in ourselves, like, it's like...
What are you saying, a positive power? Or?
Yeah, a positive power that, like, somehow I can find appreciation. I can get past I can get past all the judgments I've made. Say they're wearing those certain clothes, or they're walking a certain way. Then, you know, I can just appreciate them. So... if I come up and talk to you after this interview, watch out.
But all her friends are watching, so she's now like, she's going to have to go and Rasika is saying, if you're my friend, you will see my faults. So that's something different. No, he said in the context, to put this in context, that if someone praises me, he's my enemy, but if someone faults me, he's my friend, which is not that he was saying that his disciples should go out and fault their godbrothers, but he was saying it, if it comes to you, then you see it as welcome, because this person is exposing some disease or some impurity you have that you aren't looking at, you aren't seeing, so you can work on it. So it's not like, oh, well, so Bhakti Siddhanta said, so we could interpret it, oh, so Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, now if I'm really your friend, Bhakti, then I'm going to tell you everything that's wrong with you. No, it's the other way around. If somebody tells me there's something wrong with me, then I accept they're my friend. And why did he say that? Because we need to improve ourselves. That's the whole, you know, that's what spiritual life is. It's improving. So if somebody points out a fault that I haven't seen, or I did see but I was afraid to acknowledge, then...
You know, I think that it's an important thing to point out that if you are my friend, you will see my faults. And I find myself, I tend to be quite critical. So if I see someone I'm kind of criticizing and I kind of want to give them some self-help and be like, look, just do what I say and you'll be good, you know? So if I ever have that tendency, I check myself and I say, am I completely sure it's coming from a place of just honestly caring for them? And really, I really care for them. And most of the time, it's coming from a place of just kind of like, I know better. I know what's going on. And so I say it's better to just be quiet. Like, even if they would benefit from what I would say or something, I just say it's not really coming from a place of care and concern. It's coming from a place of my own, like, ego. So I just let it go.
The problem fixer?
Yeah, the problem fixer.
The problem fixer ego?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's a good point, because that's a natural question. So you see something, okay, you're trying to see the good in somebody, and obviously something's going on with this person where they're on the wrong track, and you know it, you've been on that track, you've corrected yourself, yes. You know how to do it, mm-hmm. So naturally you want to tell them. So that's always comes up. That's always the question, well, how do I do that? So I think that's the perfect answer. If you have the heart to do it, and they have the heart to hear it, or you can create the heart to hear it, then go for it.
It's a relationship.
And if you don't have the heart to do it, or they don't have the heart to hear it, then they're going to be offended by it.
Exactly.
But there's something even more scary about this. Hmm. That the general principle is, what we're critical in others is something that we want to avoid seeing in ourselves. And that's why we become concerned, because it won't bother you if someone else has a fault unless you yourself have it, because you have to have experienced it for it to bother you in another person. So it's also a sign for us, if we're being critical, to stop and turn it back and say, why is this bothering me? Is it that I'm doing that? Or there's some, you know, you might say, well, I don't do that. But then if you look deeper, you'll see, well, maybe there's some residual of that's still, you're out of alignment because you don't think you're that way, or you don't want to be that way, but you still are.
Yeah.
And so now
it's a mirror. It's like what we see in people. It's a mirror. There's this one quote, I don't remember who said it, but when a man gives his opinion of the world, he's actually confessing his character. So I really think that that's an important thing. Whenever we see, when other people are full of faults, we have these same faults. I really believe that that is just a mirror. And actually, whatever we admire or appreciate in others is what we can admire and appreciate in ourselves, and that we look for those qualities. And there's that term called sarigrahi, which means seeking the essence. Sar means the essence, and grahi means the seeker. So finding the essence and taking away all the chaff, you know, and all those faults, because I think it's a powerful tool at the same time to know that it's a mirror, because if I see in somebody else a fault, then it's actually quite clear that, oh, you know what? I actually have the same fault, and it helps me to objectively come to peace with that fault and work towards it. So it's almost like it's a tool to be used, and that if I see a fault in someone, it doesn't mean I have to go and tell them and do a whole, I'm going to fix you. I can fix myself. Like, I'll take that tendency and fix myself.
All right. So it's a very important point, because a lot of people who are listening to this might be thinking, I don't know a lot of people, but some people are going to be thinking, wait a minute, I don't have that fault that I'm seeing. So I think that's really the problem right there.
Yes.
That we don't recognize it.
Uh-huh.
And the reason we may not recognize it is because the fault is so out of line with who we think we are, that it's too painful to acknowledge that I'm actually like that. Now, there's a second point. Finding fault is one thing, but I don't know if we want to call this jealousy or envy, but sometimes we see another person and we'll be critical of what they're doing because we actually would like to be in that position. Mm-hmm. Say, well, he's just doing that because he wants to accumulate reputation. He wants to, you know, that's why he's doing this, or that's why he's coming on this program, or that's why he's leading the kirtan, or that's why he's giving the class. And so we can also see that as autobiographical and say, wait a minute, why is that bothering me? Is it that I want to be in the limelight? And so this actually just came up this morning in reading an email in which some devotee was complaining or trying to explain the motives of what people are doing. And I could see within that some kind of discouragement that this devotee got the good deal and I got the bad deal, and I would have liked to get the good deal, but I didn't take the same position he took, so only the people who take that position get the good deal, and now I'm feeling bad just for being a rank and file devotee. And I didn't get the same benefits. Mm-hmm.
It's more a question of envy that person wants that position and the power of, and he doesn't have it.
So then the interesting thing about envy is that sometimes we become envious of someone simply, you know, the person like is a great person, lovable person. We could be best friends with them if we wanted to cultivate that relationship. But they have something. It could be one thing that they have that we want. And all of a sudden, for no other reason, we're envious. So we have to...
Spoils everything.
So if we can turn everything around, look at it. Yes. You see, a big thing is the second verse of Shashastakam. You know, it really forms the basis of how we should chant our rounds. Mm. So humility, and what does Mahaprabhu say? Respecting others, wanting no honor for myself, wanting to give it to others. And so just by this discussion, we can see how difficult it is to do that. And then what sometimes happens is we can chant and do sadhana and just hide behind that. That creates a wall. So I don't have to do that because, well, I'm chanting and I'm doing my bhakti, so that's all I need to do. Mm-hmm. And then not look at all this stuff and say, Mahatma is saying, when I see a fault, it's really my fault. When I'm envious, it's really my fault. No, I just do good sadhana and I don't think about it. So then the sadhana, then the chanting of the holy name makes it even, we become more blind to it because we think, well, I don't have to work on these things.
Well, what I think is interesting is that the content of the second verse comes before the third. So the third verse is about humility and tolerance. And in the second verse, it's about, well, the first verse is just saying all the glories of the holy name and how wonderful it is. And then the second verse of the Shikshastakam is saying, I'm so unfortunate. I don't have any attraction. Like, I have so many faults. Like, that's why I'm not attracted. It's like such a dirty mirror. I can't see anything. So you have to first be conscious before you... That's the beginning of humility. It's like just seeing how things really are. I think that that's very powerful to understand that humility isn't some kind of false thing we have to put on. It's really just being real.
Okay, so then...
So, and once we're real and understanding I have so many faults, when I look in the mirror, all those faults I see, that's me. Just understanding that, then that's a place where humility can develop.
Okay, so then I would say, based on what you said, we have to come to the point or the realization of the acceptance that if I have faults, it's okay. Because a lot of times there's this guilt there.
Uh-huh.
Well, I have a fault and it's not okay.
Yeah.
So I'll just like pretend it's not there. And that way I don't have to process the fact that I'm chanting and doing bhakti over all these years and the fault is there. Whereas if we say, no, it's okay if you have a fault, if you're dealing with it and working on it, because you'll work through it, you'll purify it.
And it can become a source of strength.
Yeah.
And that was what I found on the Japa retreat, that was, I had been chanting for a while, but on the Japa retreat, I really realized it's such a weakness. I have no faith in the holy name. It's totally like, I was like, I'm just mumbling to myself for hours on end. And it was such a hard thing for me to come to terms with. And it just really set off so much for me. And I think after that, you know, I went through this whole process where I just stopped chanting and I had to look deeper into it. And because I had such a weakness, but I kept going at it, like every day I would think about it and how can I, and I can say now, because I've been seeking, how can I chant with some more faith and more like a taste to chant, then I've been seeking that. And then like Krishna's allowing me to have a little bit, to at least be able to sit still when I chant. So, you know, like that because I wanted that, and I know that was my weakness, and now I can feel like it's like a strength in me that I can hold on to that, and because I had that weakness, and knowing that because of that weakness, I can grow stronger. It was especially a place where I could grow stronger. So
by confronting it.
By confronting it, yes. It's not a weakness. You have to be very, very strong to see that if I'm looking in the mirror and I see all those faults, to accept them and to just be like, okay, I want to become a better person. But it takes a lot of strength. It's not for the weak-minded.
Then we can... see, she's only 22. See how much she knows? I told you. So let's see if there's any... okay. I'll say one thing, then we'll read your comments. There's this idea of what fault are you pretending you don't have?
Hmm.
You know, like, just ask yourself, what am I pretending not to know? What am I pretending that's not there? Because that's where the problem is. Now, one of the things that we see a lot at the Japa retreats is as people get into it, especially the days we do 64 rounds, they actually start to see a lot of stuff. And because the mirror is getting cleansed enough that they can see it. And so it's a very common thing. So we could therefore say, at least based on that experience, I would say, that when we're chanting properly, we are able to confront it. We're in a place where there's enough humility and enough willingness to be able to deal with it. And for some devotees, when it happens, they're a little bit discouraged. They're in this state of, oh my God, I'm worse than I thought.
Mm. You're saying like chanting is a humbling experience.
It can be confusing before humbling. For it to be humbling, we have to accept it as something good, that it's okay. So, like often devotees would say, well, what am I supposed to think when I see the contamination? Because a lot of devotees were getting discouraged. It's like, oh, I came to a Japa retreat, and now I found out that I have more contamination in my heart than I thought I had. So now I'm discouraged. So the answer we always give is that this just means the process is working. So take it in a positive way, that if you're not seeing these things, that's the problem. So we reverse it and saying, well, I can't face these things because it doesn't fit with my ego, or I'm pretending they're not there, it's too difficult to work with. But actually, if the process is working, you will go into those head on, because Chaito Dharpana Marjanam, you have to see. If you're blind, how can you clean a mirror? You have to see where the dirt is. So it's a positive way of seeing the negative, and then, okay, here it is. Now we can work through it. And one of the things we teach in our forgiveness workshop is if there are feelings connected with your resentment and you don't acknowledge them, then the feelings get buried and then they act on you subconsciously, and it comes out in so many ways.
It comes out. It's I was in some of my training. It's compared to a beach ball, and you try and hold it under the water, and it's, you know, coming out of the water, and you're like, I got it under control. I got it all under control. Don't worry. And who's really controlling who? You know, what is... And it comes out anyway. Like, you're trying to control it, but it doesn't... No matter how hard you try, the beach ball is going to come out of the water. Mm. And it's controlling you, and it comes out anyway. So you might as well just face it and let it be, and let it come out of the water.
Well, and then, of course, the other point is, you're expending energy to keep it hidden, where you could be expending energy to,
exactly,
to lost cure it.
Energy.
So Kremlin's a teacher, and he has a comment. And, okay, let's go back. Bhakti and Kara. I like what was said about power, going past assumptions. Yeah. So, you know, in spiritual life, what is power? Power comes from humility. Power comes from acknowledging my fault and dealing with it. Like you were saying, and Gandhi said, takes courage to forgive. Mother Teresa said, forgiveness is the most difficult and most powerful aspect of love. It's the, you know, so to be a virtuous person, to live with good qualities is difficult. It's like swimming upstream, and downstream is the critical. You know, you just like
that's our default. That's like our default.
Yeah, the default,
it's so
setting.
Easy.
So the default setting, and then by that default setting, you end up downstream. But upstream is where Krishna is.
Yeah.
Downstream is. So, okay. So, Bhakti and Carol wants you to say more about this. I like what you said about power going past assumptions. Could you say more about this? You. Oh, you forgot what you said?
No.
You have no more to say?
Well, the college theory that I studied in developmental psychology was basically, if you're an introvert, there's power to be exploited to become more extroverted. If you're an introvert, naturally you're quiet, you know, there's power to come out, talk, you know, come out more as an extrovert, talk with people. And there's power to be exploited if you're an extrovert, you talk a lot, you're with people, and you become more introverted and you just be more quiet and introspective like that. So there's this tension of who I am and that's who I naturally am. Like being right-handed, I naturally am, I'm extroverted. So for me to develop my introverted side, it generates power. It's like synergy. That's the term, like the synergy of becoming more of the balance of my side. So
how'd you relate that to?
So false. I related that to, like, when we have some place of weakness or that needs strengthening, there's a power to be generated from where I am to where I want to be and in getting past that barrier.
Solving the problem. Yeah.
Yes, it's coming to peace with that. There's power there. And I felt that with my japa. And, you know, I'm still feeling it. I still have so much trouble with my japa. But it's still, like, there's power there, though. And it's like my heart is getting stronger, like climbing a hill. You know, your heart gets stronger if you keep doing it. And so when getting past these assumptions of people, there's a power there because...
You have to grow.
You have to grow.
Elevate, yeah.
Yes.
It's like what we taught about forgiveness. You're going to grow above it.
Yes.
You can't.
Yeah.
You can't stay down in a lower level of consciousness.
You can't sink, and you can't.
So it's an opportunity. So then we have to see everything in a positive way. Okay, I have this fault. Now it's an opportunity to find something within me that can deal with it, that can either transcend it or in some way process it. Even just a quality where it can exist and I can still exist without being affected by it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there'd be maybe so many ways to deal with it. We have to, we do that often just in trying to control our mind. And that's okay. The chatter's going on, the programming's there, the conditioning is there, but we have a particular goal we like to achieve. And so we have to somehow or other keep it in line or quiet it in some way so it won't divert us. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. So, Mitra says, we skip Kremlin. Kremlin says, as a teacher, I have to point out faults and errors in an academic setting. If I let an error go, it will reflect on me later. So, I think it goes back to that other point. It's not, you're not doing it. I mean, you could be doing it because you don't like the student. And you just, you know, you just want to get on the student's case because the student's so obnoxious. And so... Yeah. I'm sure that happens for teachers, right? It's just like,
yes, I teach and I tutor and work with kids. It can be
yeah. So you can get back at this student is causing you so much stress and pain.
Yes.
So you can get, now's your big chance to get back at them. Actually, there's a story. There's a story of a student I don't forget what the class was, but they had to bring in a leaf collection. They're like 30, 40 leaves all labeled, and the student refused to do it. And the teacher said, you have to do it to graduate. And he said, I know all the leaves. I don't have to go out, waste my time doing it. And they sent him to the principal's office and the whole thing. And this student ended up becoming a professor, and he taught developmental psychology, I think, also. And when he became a professor, like, you know, 10, 15 years later, his teacher from the leaf class ended up in his class.
Really?
So he was joking. So your assignment is you have to collect, you know, 20 leaves. So it was like, okay, here's my chance to get back. So as a teacher, you're pointing out a fault out of affection because you know if you let it go by, it's not fair to the system, not fair to the student. It's you know, it's like a parent correcting. But, you know, it's all about motive. We always have these discussions in our forgiveness class. Well, how can I, if this person did something illegal or abusive and the person needs to be punished, how can I punish him and forgive him? And so I always liken it to a judge. A judge can't be prejudiced. A judge may sentence someone to life imprisonment, but he shouldn't do it because he doesn't like the person. He just evaluates. His heart has to be, he has to be objective. So in the same way, if you actually forgive somebody, then you can be objective, more objective in how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. So you're not punishing the student because you don't like the student. Mm-hmm. You're punishing them, so-called, because you know that's going to help them. Mm-hmm. And so it appears like criticism. It's not really criticism. It's really love. It's really affection. And I think it's so much different when you're in a position in which your job is to do that, as opposed to when nobody asks you. You send your opinion out and it's like, well, thanks. Who asked you for that?
Yeah. Yes.
So, so Mitra says, yes, when something in another person annoys me most, I usually find that it is a fault I have in myself, whether I'm conscious or unconscious of it. But seeing it in others allows me to recognize it in myself. Otherwise, it would not bother me so much. So that's, Mitra, that's a person who's willing to look at themselves, to look at their fault, and in a positive way. So that's a really good quality. And by doing that, it really protects us or defends us from fault-finding. Or we stop ourselves as soon as we do, and we just turn everything around.
We can make it like the most humbling experience.
Yeah.
That we can turn it around and say, oh, this person is horrible, like this and this. And then it's so humbling to just say, you know, to take it in a healthy way, you know, not that like I'm just damaging myself, but in a way that I can be introspective. Yeah. One of my favorite concepts in Krishna consciousness is, I don't know who said it, maybe you can tell me, but we need to be Prabhupada. We need to be conscious before Krishna conscious. Yeah. So if we can even just be conscious, you know, we can be human beings, because I think it's coming out of that ignorance. We have so much of that. And I think ignorance is such a horrible, it's like a blight. It's where actually so much of the suffering in this world comes from.
Well, there's a really, a really important point here. About you're talking about the default setting.
Yes.
So in my life, one of the things that the biggest breakthrough for me in my own development, both materially and spiritually, is understanding the default setting. Because a lot of us come up to this, well, I'm just a critical person, or I'm just, this is how I am. Well, there are 8 personality types, and I'm a this. Or, you know, I mean, you can study psychology and get it.
It's an excuse, really. Yeah.
So, when you look at that, you say, that's a big trap. And then there are beliefs behind it. So I'm telling you this right now, and I'm sure some of you out there are going, no, well, I'm just this way. You know, no matter what I say, there's a belief behind that I'm just this way. Well, what's the belief? There has to be something that's molded that. Some experience may have gotten you there. And I'll just tell you this. It's really funny, this experience I had. When I was young, somehow or other, I don't know if it's still in vogue, but when I was young, in the neighborhood I grew up, it was in vogue when you're about 10 years old to learn how to play golf. Or
that's
not even
quite odd. That's very odd. Golf?
It's odd for someone growing up as a devotee.
Or just in the 21st century.
Yeah, no, people still do it. So they're all in Florida, in South Florida, and they're all retired. No, young people actually do it. Tiger Woods must have been pretty young when he started. So, well, golf, bowling, tennis, baseball, basketball, football, is all the stuff we did. But so, you know, as kids growing up, we just kind of go with the flow. Okay, all my friends are playing golf. My parents are playing golf. So I started playing golf with my friends, and then when I was a little older, I play with my father. So I don't remember having any lessons. I don't remember having a teacher. It's just kind of, here's your clubs, here's the ball. And you go to driving range, and driving range is not the course, so you hit like hundreds of balls in an hour. So, you know, it's like playing hundreds of games. So I go to the driving range all the time, hit balls, and then I'd start playing. So then by the time I got to be around 13 years old, I was really good. I mean, it was like, you know, when somebody's exceptionally good at something, like I was good, particularly, I never took a lesson. So my father was always like, he'd play golf with me, and he'd be looking at my swing, and he'd go, "How did you do that?" And they're all like looking at me, analyzing, you know. So what happened at that point was it got to the point where I started doing as well and sometimes beating. So my father, who was at that point, he was 55 and I was 13. So I'm this little punk 13-year-old kid is beating, you know, everyone who's in their 50s who've been playing golf for the last 30 years or so. And so from that experience, it ingrained in me what an identity. And the identity was, I don't have to learn how to do something. It's either you have it and you just do it, or you don't. So, you know, if you have trouble doing something, tough luck, you didn't inherit the genes, and you can't really learn. And I would see people like play the piano, and I would, you know, or someone I knew played the piano, and they read music. And I'd say, "Hey, you want to jam? Can you just jam?" And they go, "No, I need sheet music." And I go, and in my mind, I'd go, "You're not a musician."
Yeah.
You know, and they'd be playing like incredibly well. You know, you'd be drooling listening to them. And in my mind, it's like, well, you're not a musician. You don't know how to jam. You had to learn. That's a cop-out. So just one experience in our life can develop an identity that, well, this is the way I am. I don't learn. You know, it's like, here's the software. I don't read the manual. If I can't figure out how to use it, the software is no good. And they should, you know. So we all have so many experiences by which we develop beliefs about who we are and what we can and can't do, and we think that's rigid, and, well, I'm just a fault finder, or I'm just to this, or I'm just to that, and that's death for us. Well, you know, I'm never going to be Krishna conscious in this life because, where did that because come from? Well, there's so many becauses in there that are influencing us, so, you know, we can't discover all the becauses in the next minute or two, but just so you're aware of that, that it's, don't limit yourself to this is how you are, but try to understand you may have had experiences that created the beliefs that you're that way.
Yeah, the conditioning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're not even aware of how it happened.
That's the hardest part, not even knowing
I'll tell you another thing. Sure. This is amazing thing. When I was a young devotee, I was trained by another devotee. And this devotee, his service was to go somewhere, start a temple, get it going, and turn it over to someone else. And he said, Prabhupada wanted 108 temples. So he said, Prabhupada said, you know, 108 temples. And I guess at that point, Prabhupada said, these senior devotees should go somewhere, set up the temple, train people, and go away. So I had this programmed into me. And from the time I joined ISKCON until I joined in 19. I moved in the temple in January of 1970. Until I moved to Alachua, I did a different service every 2 years, because when the service was going on smoothly, then I had that conditioning, that belief. Well, that's when you move on.
Time to go.
So, you know, I look back and I go, why did nothing last more than 2 years for almost 30 years? Nothing. You know, it was like, okay, that's set up. Everything's in place. I didn't think, let's build the next floor. So you know, and I always wondered, why was it? It's like the 2 year period. I would always move. I was wondering. And then I traced it back. I go, oh, it was that one conversation in which this devotee said, build it up and leave. And so that was my belief, that was my eternal dharma. So we don't know how we're being conditioned. We think, well, that's my nature. I have to move. I can't sit in one place. That's not true. It just came from that one thing that got programmed. Yeah. So
I find that being born and raised as a Hare Krishna, there's so much conditioning that we kind of come in with, like japa and class. It's like the most, I mean, I remember going on a japa retreat and I was like, oh my God, 3 days straight of japa and class. This must be like a nightmare. I mean, it was just really, it's like ingrained in me where it's just like, oh God, class, or oh my God, japa. It's something it takes so much work to get over. And it's some things that are kind of unique maybe to just having it around since birth. But then there's also
Anchored in what? Anchored in pain or boredom? Or?
Boredom. Boredom and like being told what to do and not, and I don't want to accept your authority. And
Does that have anything to do with like seeing a lot of devotees chant japa who seem to be bored?
Yes. And falling asleep. And people falling asleep. And also seeing people who chant japa that maybe they're not inspired in their spiritual life. Like, do I really want to be like this person who's been chanting for 30 years? What's the big deal? And so I think a lot of Gurukulis, they tend to kind of like cut out all the stuff and they say, what's the essence? Be real with me. And just take that. And I find that's why so many Gurukulis love kirtan, because kirtan is the essence of so many things. And so, but I think that there's great power in understanding if maybe, I know I have a weakness with japa, especially listening to class, that if I can somehow overcome that, then there's like something to be gained. And and I know already it's really, okay. And also accepting authority and listening to my spiritual
master. Okay, so this is perfect. And we're talking, it's almost like connected. It can be connected to an identity that, well, I'll never really have a taste for japa. You know, I'm 20 years old. I haven't had a taste. Yeah. It's just like, or our generation doesn't have a taste.
I'm just a Gurukuli. Because, I can never chant. Yeah, it's like so impossible.
So you see all these.
And it actually, now that I chant steadily, it's something that bothers me in other say Gurukulis or people. They kind of take it. They don't do it. And so it's something I realize I just have it in myself that I wasn't doing it for so long. And just seeing it in others is just a fault of my own.
Yeah. So. But you're also seeing that it can be done.
It can be done. And that's where I kind of feel a little bit like, come on, come out to par, because I know it can be done. I'm like, I'm on that path. Like, join me. Yeah. And I think this really relates back to what we even began our whole talk with, about when we have relationships that are tough and we're in that stressful environment, we have to realize we come with everyone as their conditioning, and it's all thrown into the pot, you know. And I might believe something, and then who I'm with, you know, they believe something else, and they have all these patterns, and it has nothing to do with me, like all their things, but there's this nature, like the ego, oh my god, it's all about me, so everything they do, it's like, oh my, I'm taking it so personally and everything, but really it just comes from their conditioning, my conditioning, and it's like this like battle, but it really is just understanding they are who they are. And it's, you know.
Well, this is a good point. What time is it? How much more time do we have? Oh, I have a watch. I should look at my watch. It's 9:00. We started at 9:04, so
8:04.
We started at 8:04. Let's do a few more minutes. Of course, anyone who wants to leave can. So Mitra says, "When faults," this is from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. "When faults and others misguide you and delude you, have patience. Misguide you and delude you." This is so powerful. Just kind of feel this rather than intellectualize it. When faults and others misguide you and delude you. That means as soon as you see a fault in others, you're immediately being misguided by it and deluded by it if you keep meditating on it. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, just by seeing it, that's immediately the next step. You see the fault, and now you're misguided. Your consciousness is in the fault of the other person. So now you're misguided. Have patience. So he says, have patience. Don't take it out on them. Have patience. Be tolerant with them. Introspect. In other words, I'm seeing this, turn it around. Introspect means look in yourself.
That's beautiful.
Find faults in yourself. And as we're talking, we'll just find that same fault in yourself. That's the most convenient and obvious. Then he says, know that others cannot harm you unless you harm yourself. In other words, their fault can't harm you, can't misguide you and delude you, unless you allow it to by meditating on it. You know, there's, okay, so-and-so has a fault. Everybody can see it's an objective fact. This person has a fault. Does that fault have to harm you? No, unless you allow it to, unless it becomes an issue for you. So now, why does it become an issue? So you mentioned this point of people are mixing and we all have our own issues, and then we mix together and it's It's not about them. It's just how I how I'm responding to them. So I was thinking, if you ever have a sore, let's say you were hit really hard, you know, this big black and blue spot, or you know, you're playing football for kids, for boys, you know, every day we had cuts and scrapes growing up, you know, playing and fighting, and you know. So, but I'm sure everyone in their life has done something where they either get a boil or a cut or something, and you just touch it, and it's like, ow! You know, just touch it. So, inevitably, you're going to see a friend, hey, how you doing? And you're going to go, ow! And he's going to jump back, you know? And all that friend was doing was being affectionate.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your reaction at affection? This is like intense pain because you have a sore there. So someone says something and we react, not because of what they did, but because of the sore that they touched within us. And so often we don't recognize there's a sore there, and that's why we blame them. But all they're doing is touching a sore. Now, if they did the same thing and the sore wasn't there, wouldn't bother us at all.
Yes.
So that's an important factor. So we have a few more comments before we end. Brenda Lee can't be in the chat room at the same time watching the screen because the screen freezes. Anyway, technical difficulties. Adi, nice class again. Thank you. What of criminals, persons of dangerous character? How do we see them or deal with them? You want to hear something amazing? Maybe you know about this. It's this Hawaiian man was brought in to help criminals, and these were like the worst criminals. I guess it was in Hawaii, you know, top security.
I think I've heard of this.
The worst criminals. So he went into this meditation, and whatever their fault was, he identified it in himself. And he worked on himself, and when he worked on himself, they got cured, and that whole prison was shut down. Everyone in the prison transformed. So he accepted, I mean, this is a pretty high level of consciousness. He accepted their fault as his fault. And Prabhupada once said, if you see a problem, you think it's my fault. So, I mean, the way we could take it, that is really high up there. At least the way we can take it is, if there's a fault in anyone, my fault is, number one, I'm not compassionate to them, or I'm not modeling the quality which would inspire them to overcome their fault. I mean, there are many ways we can think. That's two ways. So we can kind of take responsibility, because I see the general tendency is not to take responsibility. It's just to point the finger. But do I have any responsibility? If I were more Krishna conscious, would that change in any way this person's behavior? If this person saw that I wasn't finding fault, that I was appreciating, would that affect them in any way for them to be more appreciative of others? And the answer obviously is, on some level it would. So we can think that way. So we're going to end here. Oh, we have a conversation going on. Calling a thief, is that always realistic? There are those who injure children. I'm not sure where this conversation is going. I think the point is that we're talking about ordinary relationships between people we work with, between friends. When you're dealing in this whole world of thieves, criminals, child molestation, it's like it's a different world. There's different rules there. And then it's not dealing with personal so much now with your own envy and your own faults and so forth. You're dealing with...
I think we can take the essence of what is being said here about understanding what we see in faults, and it's been the theme for this whole talk, and that I think we can make stronger relationships by humility. I think that's actually the theme of this, is humility is understanding how many faults we do have. It's not being... blowing it out of proportion. It's just being real. Yeah. It's just understanding who we are. And my spiritual master often says that it's like, humility is just being real. Like, we really are that insignificant. Like, we are just specks, and we do have so many faults. So it is saying that. So when we're just seeing this as a tool of seeing what people have faults in others, that we can make that as a tool to become stronger character of ourselves and have stronger relationships, and especially in relationships where we're having our friends or our family or our, you know, children, our husbands, wives, and that can really make it a stronger relationship just by humility and seeing that.
Well, I want to even take it to a scary, to a level we haven't spoken that's a little scary based on this point. If we're talking about criminals, sometimes our animosity towards a criminal comes from the fact that we are getting in touch with something, or there's something inside of us that's saying, and we don't want to admit it, that I have a side of me that could actually do something like that.
Hmm.
And it becomes so...
That's a little intense.
It becomes so repulsive. And everyone's out there saying, there's no way I would kill. There's no way I would molest a child. There's no... So... But if it's really charged with aversion, like strong aversion, it's something to ask yourself: is why am I so adverse? Is everybody that? I mean, other people they're not that adverse to it. They're just like, this is horrible. We have to do something about it. But if I'm going off the edge of aversion, is there something?
It seems like a prickly issue, because I think that there's a lot of... Some people might have had an experience where it was very difficult for them. And, you know, being a Gurukuli, I grew up in New Vrindavan, where there are a lot of my friends who had a very hard time growing up as a Gurukuli. And, you know, some people have a lot of, you know, pain associated with that and a lot of aversion. It's intense. So, you know, I don't know. It's hard to make kind of...
Yeah,
generalization.
I wouldn't say that to people who had gone through that. I would only say to people who hadn't, just to look. I mean, it's a bad issue to deal with. If we look at some other issue, that, like some political issue, and people are very for or very against, and it's interesting to see how people argue points of view, especially when they're very much against something, like extremely against something, and what is that saying about their own character or their own ability to understand another point of view? Or what is it about this other side that is just, you know, if you're a conservative, the liberal side, it could just agitate you to no end. And if you're a liberal, the conservative side could agitate. Is there some liberal side in you that you're afraid of, that if it manifests would become a tiger and eat somebody? Mm-hmm. Or if you're a liberal, is there some conservative side in you that you're afraid would destroy? It's just, you know, it's just another bringing it back to look at ourselves. And obviously, if someone has been abused as a child, I think it's an entirely different realm.
Yeah.
And okay, so we're going to end here. We wanted to thank you all. And if there's anything you missed, this class is going to go on Krishna.com/Mahatma as an audio file, and it will be up sooner or later as a video file. And if you have any further questions to ask Bhakti Lata, then what should they do?
Well, I don't know if I can say this. You can also go to my blog.
Okay.
My blog is Seed of Devotion, SEEDOF. Devotion .blogspot.com
.blogspot.com
and that's where I write, and I do a lot of, you know, introspection. I share different realizations, and you can also post comments and ask questions or whatever that is.
Okay, now you got me on a roll. You can go to my blog spot.
I didn't know you had one.
Yeah, as of like a week or two ago. It's called Yoga of Forgiveness at blogspot.
At?
Yeah.
I think it's dot Blogspot.
No, mine is definitely at.
Okay.
If you go
seems
to hers,
like an email address.
At blogspot.com, because it's a Gmail.
That seems like an email, though. An email account.
We're going to try it right now.
Okay.
We're having trouble here. Let's see what happens.
Let's see.
So what do you have to do to get on? You have to have a Gmail account?
Try .blogspot.com.
No, that's right. .blogspot.com. Oh, it is?
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Yes.
So at Blogspot is how I get on.
That's your address. That's how you sign in. And then
oh, no. I have to change my website. So we have a website also called yogaforgiveness.com. And this website is dedicated for the seminars we're doing. If you want to find out about it or you want to organize a seminar in your area or a local yoga studio or church or where you work, you know, to 10,000 people at your job, that would be super. So you can check that out. All right. So I had an amazing realization tonight that it's .blogspot. We had some like, yeah, this was the best thing that happened all day.
That I .blogspot.
That I gave everybody at the last two seminars the wrong blogspot address for some reason. So now they're going to go on and, well, now you know how to get on something that writes, so now I can go on anyone's blogspot and write blogs just by going at, right? If I don't have the password, yeah. So there it is, this beautiful, I don't know, they can't see that, can they? Just us? No, we're looking at my beautiful website now. It's called Yoga Forgiveness, Making Peace with Your Karma. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. And we'll have another surprise guest from the Jewels of Alachua next week. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Jai. Okay.
It's done?